A U.S. soldier detained in North Korea. In Sweden, communities dealing with an outbreak of gun violence. And in Washington, the White House welcomes the figurehead president of Israel, Isaac Herzog, not the prime minister.
Obviously, Mr. Herzog is the face of Israel that Mr. Biden wants to see, rather than Mr. Netanyahu.
The delicate dance of supporting an ally while keeping its controversial leader at arm's length. Also, a sport from ancient Persia that combines martial arts, wrestling, and calisthenics is gaining new followers. Iranian women say it's high time they jumped in the pit, too. This woman says she tells the men to mind their own business. She is competing. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thank you for being with us. Israeli President Isaac Herzog is enjoying a warm welcome at the White House today. Tomorrow, he'll speak to a joint session of Congress and spend some more time with President Biden. The real focus of attention, though, is on the person not being welcomed in Washington. That would be Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. He hasn't visited Washington since his return to office 7 months ago. To understand why and the significance, we reached out to former Israeli diplomat Alon Pincus in Tel Aviv. He served as chief of staff to four Israeli foreign ministers and was Israel's consul general in New York. Alon Pincus, in Israel, the presidency, as you know, is a largely ceremonial post. The real juice lies in the prime minister's office, and yet President Isaac Herzog's U.S. visit would seem to be a full-on political diplomatic event, right?
Oh, it most certainly is, Marco. And Mr. Netanyahu was not invited conspicuously, not invited by President Biden for almost 7 months, which is unprecedented since 1969, by the way, when the first prime minister visited the White House. Usually an invitation is extended, and a visit, which by Israeli standards is a coronation of sorts for an incoming Israeli prime minister. A visit usually takes place within weeks, if not a few short months. Yet President Biden, for political reasons and because of Mr. Netanyahu's policies, both domestic and foreign, has decided not to invite him. But then all of a sudden, because of Netanyahu's uninvitation, it became a political circus with Mr. Herzog meeting the president and the secretary of state and the national security advisor and the speaker of the house and the minority leader, and then moving to New York and even meeting the secretary general of the UN.
So what does all of this tell us about the status of U.S.-Israeli relations at this moment, that the invitation goes to the president and sometime later this year we hear Biden and Netanyahu might meet in the halls of the UN?
Yeah, key word being might. Relationship has been strained for the last 7 months due to what I mentioned before, Netanyahu's policies, a constitutional coup d'etat, or he chooses to call it a judicial overhaul or judicial reform, with the intent of weakening the judiciary significantly and creating a hollow democracy. That is not seen positively or patiently or tolerably by President Biden. Then comes Netanyahu's policies in the West Bank vis-a-vis the Palestinians, with ministers left and right, well, not left and right politically, but left and right of Mr. Netanyahu, calling for annexation and enhancement of occupation and what have you.
So, Alon Pincus, you're in Tel Aviv, where today tens of thousands of Israelis protested against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's judicial overhaul, as they've been doing for months now. There are many protesters with signs and drawings saying, "Biden save us" and "America help." What is it that the protesters want the Biden White House to do?
These protesters want Mr. Biden and the U.S. to meddle, to interfere, to exert influence. I don't think that's going to happen, and I don't even think it's a good idea. This has to be organic. This has to come from within. It is coming from within via the protests. And so while I understand the sentiment it expresses, I doubt the political efficacy or feasibility of it.
Well, as you said a moment ago, the U.S. was once seen as the broker, the only broker for Mideast peace. Those days, safe to say, are mostly gone. And yet heads still turn expectantly to the U.S. with the question, what are you going to do about it? I'm wondering, does engaging with President Herzog inspire confidence for Israelis who feel that way?
No, not necessarily, because the Israeli public is split into half. Half are thinking that Mr. Herzog is going to represent Netanyahu, and plea his case and essentially trying to convince President Biden to invite him to alleviate these tensions. The other half is saying, come on, Biden understands and knows Israeli politics since he became a senator in 1973. Surely he knows that the president in Israel has no executive powers, and surely he knows that the president of Israel, that is, since these protests began, is a figure that is controversial rather than unifying. Obviously, Mr. Herzog is the face of Israel that Mr. Biden wants to see, rather than Mr. Netanyahu.
And drilling down on that, what does Washington want from Israel at this moment?
To be honest, I think they want us to get off the radar. You know, there's a presidential daily briefing, the PDB.
You're talking about the PDB at the White House, obviously, yeah.
Yes, correct, of course. The PDB, in which Israel appears too often in the eyes of the Americans, they're saying, guys, you know, we're dealing with Ukraine, we're dealing with China, we're dealing with the enlargement, expansion, and strengthening of NATO. Get off our screens. You're becoming a constant irritant, and you're supposed to be a dependable and reliable ally. On top of that, the sense I get from other people in D.C. and Washington is that there is an Israeli retreat from the foundations of our alliance, from what is called the shared values, that we share values of democracy, liberal not in the American political context, but liberal democracy in the type of regime and checks and balances and so on. And so there is a growing impatience, and that is a bad signal, a bad omen for this relationship.
What are your hopes still about the U.S. role, realistically, as long as Netanyahu is prime minister of Israel?
I don't expect Mr. Biden to interfere crudely and boldly in Israeli politics, because he's not going to do this, and I'm not certain about how effective that's going to be. So as long as this government, this particular government, headed by this particular prime minister, Mr. Netanyahu, is in power, I have no expectations from the U.S., to be honest.
What are you going to be watching for most closely in the coming days, Alon?
Look, one of the major amendments that Mr. Netanyahu launched passed a first reading. A bill becomes a law. The Israeli version is that it passes three votes or three readings in parliament. It passed reading number one. Next week, it needs to pass reading number two or three. If it does pass, this is a law. It's called the reasonableness. It pertains to the judicial review powers of the Supreme Court to strike down executive decisions on grounds of unreasonableness. If that passes a second and third reading, relations with the U.S. will be further strained, on top of which I think this is going to just fuel the remainder of the protests.
Israeli diplomat Alon Pincus served as chief of staff to four Israeli foreign ministers and was Israel's consul general in New York. Thank you very much for being with us and sharing your thoughts.
My pleasure, Marco. Thank you very much.
When you move to a new country, one major challenge can be just opening a bank account. Getting a loan for a car, a home, or a new business, even harder. Across South America, new migrant arrivals are often completely shut out of the financial system. But as Manuel Ruedo reports, some companies have found that lending migrants money can be good business.
David Matei works for a cable TV company in Lima, Peru, making around $500 a month. Recently, he got his first loan ever, a $3,000 credit for a motorbike. He wanted the bike to get around, but also to make extra money making deliveries. When you're new in a place, it's complicated to buy some things, says Matei. He's Venezuelan and arrived in Peru 4 years ago, and he's usually short on cash. There weren't any companies or banks here that were willing to give me a loan, he says. That changed earlier this year, when Matei learned about a company called Galgo, which is Spanish for Greyhound. On its website, Galgo sells motorbikes that can be paid for in monthly installments. With a local ID card and proof of his income, Matei was able to get his bike financed. I thought it was going to be harder, he says. Immigrants like Matei often struggle to get access to loans because they lack a credit history in their new country. But increasingly, there are startups that are taking a chance on these newcomers and finding that lending money to migrants can be profitable. Galgo was set up in 2019 by Diego Fleischmann, a Chilean businessman. Back then, tens of thousands of Venezuelans were arriving in Chile to escape their country's economic crisis.
And we start just with the idea of giving back to these people who are coming to Chile and how we can help them in order to have financial inclusion, to develop their life in our country.
The company started out by providing loans for motorbikes, cars, and rent deposits. It even lent money to Venezuelan doctors who needed to validate their degrees in Chile and had to pay for exams.
It was something that made no sense for us, that a Venezuelan doctor was working as an Uber driver to save money to pay this fee to validate their titles. So we give a credit and they make this faster.
But the company's earnings nosedived during the pandemic, as many migrants lost their jobs and had no money to pay back their loans. There was one exception, though. Galgo found that its motorbike loans usually performed well, because after they purchased their motorbikes, migrants would start using them to work for delivery apps like Uber Eats. Fleischmann says the company decided to focus on motorbike loans.
When people do money with the loan that you are giving, they pay you in such a better way.
Nowadays, Galgo finances more than 3,000 new motorbikes each month. The company has expanded into Peru, Colombia, and Mexico.
Most of our clients now are gig workers that are migrant. They had pay back really good to us, so we didn't make an error on that bet.
But when migrants need loans for other reasons, there are still barriers. Juan Pablo Luque is an expert on microfinance at Mercy Corps, a humanitarian group that helps migrants and refugees. He works in Colombia, where many migrants are denied bank accounts if they don't have a national ID card.
They tend to go to loan sharks and other very dangerous situations, which requires them to pay absurd interest rates and puts them also in a very high-risk situation in their communities.
That's changing as digital banks start to compete with traditional banks and cater to migrants to build up their clientele. In the United States, for example, Majority has opened more than 100,000 bank accounts for immigrants in the past 3 years. The digital bank tries to make things simple. Anyone can open an account at Majority with an ID from their home country and a utility bill that shows they live in the United States. Juan Pablo de Alessandro is leading the company's expansion plans.
Getting inserted into the financial system is actually still a huge, huge hurdle for a lot of people. And that's why we're trying to make a big difference, in at least in that particular aspect of a person's establishment in the United States.
Back in Peru, David Matei says he's still wary about taking out loans from banks because of the high interest rates. But the motorbike he acquired with Galgo is helping him to increase his income and build a credit history. I feel happy about my life here, he says. I think that eventually I'll get a bigger bike and move on to new things. For The World, I'm Manuel Rueda, Bogota.
Swatch, the Swiss watchmaker, is not backing down against the Malaysian government. The company is taking the government to court. This spring, Malaysian officials raided more than a dozen Swatch retail stores and confiscated the company's line of rainbow-colored pride watches, watches that signaled support for LGBTQ rights. Swatch has now filed a lawsuit against the Malaysian government, arguing that the watches are not capable of causing any disruption to public order or morality, and that confiscating them was illegal. In Malaysia, homosexuality is a crime. The government had warned Swatch that their line of watches in rainbow colors, some with the letters LGBTQ written on them, could violate Malaysian law. The watchmaker's lawsuit against the government is set to go forward in court later this week. Still ahead this hour, the curious case of the American soldier detained in North Korea. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. It's The World. There's a global labor shortage happening right now on the high seas. The number of maritime workers is on the decline, which is having a big impact on the delivery of products across the world. To tell us more, we're joined by Elio Vicente in London. He's the Director of Employment Affairs with the International Chamber of Shipping, a global trade association. Elio, what would you say is the reason behind why there are not enough maritime workers right now?
Really, the pandemic had a huge impact on the seafaring workforce. What was unique for seafarers is that during the pandemic, whilst most of us were in lockdown, they continued to prop up world trade through their work. unfortunately, during that time, there were severe restrictions on movement, and that had a significant impact on seafarers.
So was the work just too unpredictable starting with the pandemic and a lot of seafarers walked off the job?
Not quite. What happened was attrition. So you had seafarers, for example, on contracts for, let's say, 11 months, 10 months, but they had to stay on board far beyond those contracts. Essentially, they were stuck, many of them, for quite a long time because they just could not disembark.
Have you been able to actually gauge the percentage drop in seafaring workers?
In terms of gauging the drop, if we look at the Philippines, the share of Filipino seafarers, which is by far the biggest by a single country, that used to be at 20%. Now we're looking at about 14%. Obviously, that there are the factors underlying those numbers, but those really are startling figures.
So what kind of impact is that having on global trade and just logistics and shipping?
The first thing I would say is seafarers are human beings. They're very unique people, seafarers. Taking on a job where you are away from your family and away from your loved ones for quite a significant period of time, you need to be built different. And they keep the supply chains that you've just mentioned going. In terms of the impact on supply chains today, I won't say that the shortage is having so much of an impact right now at this moment in time. But if we look into the future and not into the far future, so let's say in 2026 or thereabouts, we're predicting as ICS a shortage of about 96,000 officers. Now that will 100% have a significant impact on supply chains.
Yeah, remind us how much product in the global marketplace is shipped by boat and how crucial these maritime jobs are to the movement of those goods.
Yeah, so 90% of world trade is transported by sea. And we're talking anything from finished goods, medicines, raw materials, and so on.
How much has the war in Ukraine impacted the numbers of maritime workers available? Is there a connection there?
With the outset of the war, what happened is the access to both Russians and Ukrainian seafarers, for obvious reasons, became much more difficult. Combined, Russia and Ukraine account for about 14.5% of the global total seafaring population. So that's a pretty big number. This really emphasized something that we as an industry had already realized through COVID, that we do need to make sure that not only for the sake of the supply chain, but the sake of good practice within the industry, that we have as diverse a pool of seafarers as possible.
Elio Vicente is the Director of Employment Affairs with the International Chamber of Shipping, a global trade association for shipping. Elio joined us from London. Thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
You might not have heard of Vrasashe Palavoni, but the sport is a big thing in Iran and goes back centuries, a mix of martial arts, wrestling, and calisthenics. Now, one Iranian woman says it's time for the sport to change. The World's Shirin Jafari reports.
Marzesha Pahlavani combines sports with rhythmic music. In this video posted online, athletes form a circle in a pit. They lift two large wooden clubs above their heads and start to twist them in circular motions. The space where all this takes place is called the Zurkhane, which literally translates to House of Strength. Then the men move an iron bow from side to side and perform what's known as the shano, which is kind of like a push-up. This sport goes back more than 2,000 years to what was then the Persian Empire.
This art of Pahlavani runs like a thread throughout the history of Iran.
Khashayar Azad teaches Varzesh Pahlavani. He's based in Sydney, Australia.
There has been several waves of invasions and conquests and empires building and falling, etc. But one thing that they have had very much in common throughout the long history of Iran and the Persian culture has been Pahlavani as an art form.
Step one in mastering Varzesh Pahlavani, Azad says, is to let go of one's ego. That's why, for example, the pit in the Zurkhane sits at a lower level than the ground, to emphasize modesty and humility.
It is the art of developing and cultivating spiritual strength and physical strength to equal measure.
But what's not always been equal in this tradition? Women are not allowed to practice in the Zurkhane or mix with the men. Rayeh Mozaffarian has made it her mission to change that. Speaking from her home in Tehran, Mozaffarian tells me about her frustration as an Iranian woman interested in the sport. She says Pahlavani belongs to all Iranians, not just men. That's why she's campaigning for women to get access to the Zurkhane and to be able to form teams of their own. She says she's heard all kinds of excuses from officials and the male athletes who want to keep women out of the sport. One thing they tell me, she says, is that these exercises are too tough for women and it will make their bodies too muscular and masculine. I tell them to mind their own business, she says. Mozaffarian has met with high-level religious officials, and she says, in fact, they are not the ones standing in the way. They even issued a fatwa or religious edict, leaving the door open to women taking part. The most intense pushback, she says, comes from a small but vocal group of purists. So she's taken her campaign online. She posts about the sport on Instagram, gives interviews to the news media, and shares videos of women practicing Pahlavani at home. She says these photos of women holding the wooden clubs and practicing Pahlavani, as well as women playing the music that goes along with the sport, all that is helping to break this long-held taboo on women's participation. So far, Reyhane Mozaffarian has not been able to persuade the authorities to let women participate. But she says the recent protests against restrictions on women's freedoms in Iran have helped her cause. These protests are like a wake-up call, she says, a reminder to men that women in Iran will not stop demanding their rights, no matter how long it takes. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Many Ukrainians are rebuilding their lives in Denmark. They've settled in small rural eco-villages, safe and sustainable places, but far from home.
No matter how beautiful is here, Ukraine is my country.
Europe's new green road providing safety for Ukrainians fleeing war. Still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. An American soldier has been detained in North Korea. According to the U.S. military, the soldier went across the border willfully and without authorization. The soldier, Private Second Class Travis King, had just been released from a South Korean prison. He was being held on assault charges and was facing additional military disciplinary actions in the U.S. This is a fast-moving story. We reached out to Jenny Town earlier today. She's the director of the Stimson Center's 38 North program on North Korea.
What we understand so far of the information that's come out is that he was under disciplinary action within the military and was being sent back to the U.S. and didn't board the plane, and instead somehow got on this tour of the joint security area in Panmunjom at the military demarcation line between North and South Korea. And during the tour, he ran into the North Korean side. And so as far as we know right now, he has been detained by the KPA on the North Korean side, and it's unsure what they're going to do with him.
Yeah, so buses in South Korea take tourists to the DMZ on a regular basis, and the soldier was on one of those buses, right?
Correct, yeah.
How unusual is it for an American to be detained in North Korea?
Very rare. Usually when there are detentions in North Korea, it's like tourists or humanitarian workers who are already in country who do something that is considered against the law in North Korea. Like they'll leave Bibles somewhere, or they will intentionally, you know, enter areas where they're not supposed to, or intentionally do things that they're prohibited from doing. And in those instances, sometimes they're detained, sometimes they're questioned and released. There isn't really a set pattern. It depends a lot on the circumstances as well as the political relations at that time.
The incidences where Americans have been held in custody, what usually happens first? Is there a process you're expecting to unfold?
So usually when they're detained, you know, the jurisdiction is usually through the Ministry of Public Security, and usually access to them is granted through the Swedish embassy, of which right now there's no one in the Swedish embassy because none of the foreign ambassadors have been allowed to return except for the Chinese. But, you know, there's usually some interrogation period before they make a decision on what to do with the person. There is a sort of trial that will happen where then they do announce what charges they're bringing against them and what the sentence is. The jurisdiction can vary depending on if the North Koreans consider us at a state of war or not. And then access is granted on a limited basis through the Swedish ambassador that usually is residing in Pyongyang.
Yeah, I mean, what you mentioned there about the lack of any diplomatic emissary right now, that seems like a big problem. How does the U.S. communicate with North Korea when there is no diplomatic presence in the country, not even this channel through the Swedish embassy?
I would say because it happened within the demilitarized zone, right now this is a military-to-military discussion that's probably going on, or something that the Neutral Nation Supervisory Commission is involved in. He wasn't in North Korea, you know, when he got detained, but this is all something that's happening within this military zone.
And I'm dancing around this fact. I mean, this is a member of the U.S. military. How does that change the equation?
It's complicated. It has happened before, but not since like the Korean War. There were, I think, 6 defectors at that time of American military who defected to North Korea. Some were just disillusioned by the war. Some were also facing some kind of disciplinary action and decided to defect instead. You know, he wasn't on duty when it happened. So yet it was a civilian tour. It's really unclear how that's going to be handled because there really isn't a lot of precedent for it.
Yeah, but Jenny, just to be clear, we don't know if this is a defection or not.
Correct. Yeah, we don't know the whole story here. We're getting bits and pieces as it goes along, whether he's really trying to defect or whether it was just a stunt to try and, you know, avoid whatever disciplinary action was coming to him. The idea that he thought that going to North Korea was a better deal is a little hard to believe. So, yeah, we don't know what's going to happen to him. And presumably, if he is returned back to the U.S., then he will still go under whatever military disciplinary action he was meant to.
Stepping back for a moment, Jenny, where are U.S.-North Korea relations at right now?
They're at a very low point. You know, there hasn't been direct talks since about 2019. There hasn't been much of a communication channel in general. Even the hotlines that exist, the North Koreans have not been answering them in the past year and a half or so. All the joint military exercises that have been going on, both bilateral and trilateral in the region, there's a lot of very muscular and aggressive rhetoric that's been going back and forth between Seoul, Washington, and Pyongyang.
Jenny Town is the director of the Stimson Center's 38 North program on North Korea. Jenny, thank you very much. Always good to speak.
Thanks, Marco.
Days after the first Russian missiles were launched on Ukraine last year, a group of ecologists and activists in Denmark and Ukraine forged what they dubbed the Green Road, an interactive map of eco-villages across Europe willing to host displaced Ukrainians, some of whom were already trying to live sustainably in Ukraine, practicing permaculture, for example. The World's Amanda Lichtenstein traveled to Halling-e-Lille, Denmark, where a handful of Ukrainians are restarting their lives.
Irina Kazakova rolls her suitcase down a gravel road into Halling-e-Lille, an eco-village in rural Denmark. She is greeted with warm hugs on her return from visiting her parents in Kharkiv. Before the war, Kazakova was a permaculturalist back home in Ukraine. For now, Kazakova lives here, among endless grassy fields dotted with white dandelion flowers, horses grazing in the pasture, and a constant choir of chirping birds. It's in stark contrast to the alarms and explosions in Ukraine amid the ongoing war. But sitting on the deck of the common house overlooking a small, peaceful lake, Kazakova says she can't help but feel homesick.
You get used to normal life here, and that's okay. Even no matter how beautiful is here, Ukraine is my country, and I want to go home.
For now, though, she says it's safer in Denmark, and she has lots to do here. Kazakova is one of the founders and coordinators of the Green Road, which provides safe places for displaced Ukrainians. Eco-villages are communities that focus on sustainable living, and there are over 10,000 of them around the world. Last year, as the first bombs exploded in Ukraine, Kazakova says a flurry of calls with her colleagues led to the idea for a Green Road. They realized they could offer these communities as a refuge. And calls started to pour in from everywhere.
A little bit later, we had a call, like everyone from Global Eco Village Network started to call us from every country, from Germany, from Denmark, from Hungary, from Poland. The whole day it was just calls, how are you, what were doing it.
Kazakova says these calls were like an island of stability in an unstable world. A map began to circulate online with contact details for every eco-village willing to host within Ukraine and across Europe. Natalia Masel from Kyiv followed the Green Road with her family to Hilingilile, with stops along the way in Romania, the Czech Republic, Austria, and Germany. The mother of five is resting on the deck after a swim in the lake when we meet. Here, everyone is part of several working groups, and Masel chose to grow vegetables. She points to the greenhouse where new tomato and cucumber plants are thriving.
And it's when we came from Ukraine, it was like we have no job, and we were searching for the job. And it was like the first thing I begin to do because I need to do something. And we last year we had a lot of tomatoes growing them there.
Hilingilile was established 15 years ago on the grounds of an old pig farm. Today, there are about 20 houses with a forest, veggie gardens, a yoga and meditation room, an arts studio, a sauna, and a common house where members often share meals together.
Then the war broke out, and our path immediately turned to be like a, yeah, as we normally say, very agile development organizations, both in Ukraine and in Denmark.
Camilla Nielsen Englust is the head of Denmark's National Association of Eco-Villages, one of the oldest national eco-village networks in the world. Nielsen Englust lives in Hilingilile and is a key organizer of the Green Road. While cutting fresh watermelon on the deck, she remembered the earliest days of the project.
Like this first year of war, especially this first 6 months, we were quite busy. We didn't know what would happen. So we had to prepare as much as we could, and that's also why we applied for all these funds.
The group secured a grant of about $90,000 from an emergency fund through Denmark's consortium of civil society organizations. They even won a cash award for their initiative in April. And several private donors and everyday Danes also stepped in to help. Nielsen Englust says that established friendships made it possible to act quickly and collectively on a humanitarian response. Kazakova is in constant contact with her colleagues back home, and she said they're seeing a major transformation at the eco-villages in Ukraine.
And what I see now, like, our eco-villages, they become stronger. They grow, they start to communicate in another way, they start to listen to each other more than it was before, and they feel the power of unity.
Kazakova says she keeps the millions of Ukrainians who continue to live in fear at the forefront of her mind while living in Denmark. And as the war continues in Ukraine, so does the Green Road toward a more peaceful and sustainable future. For the World, I'm Amanda Lichtenstein, Hilingilile, Denmark.
Here's what would seem like a good news story out of Afghanistan. The Taliban have managed to cut opium poppy cultivation by almost 90%. That's something the international community spent decades trying and failing to do. The Taliban did it in less than 2 years since their return to power. Our next guest is not exactly cheering the news. Vonda Felbab-Brown is the director of the Initiative on Non-State Armed Actors at the Brookings Institution. Vonda, first of all, how did the Taliban manage to cinch up the opium business?
Well, first of all, the Taliban allowed almost a year of harvesting and cultivation once it issued a ban that the Taliban allowed communities, households, and their commanders to harvest. Then it moved into serious implementation this winter and spring. And it was able to succeed because it has been implemented in Afghanistan, a highly repressive authoritarian state. There have been many arrests of individuals for any kind of challenge to authorities, and this has clearly also extended to the opium ban.
So when the Taliban retook power in Afghanistan in 2021, estimates suggest the drug economy accounted for at least 14% of the country's GDP. So just going by the numbers, what is that figure today?
Since the Taliban came to power, there has been significant shrinkage of Afghanistan's GDP, with 90% of the population in poverty, many slipping into poverty. In fact, some economists talk about a starvation equilibrium or a famine equilibrium in Afghanistan. So to remove about $1 billion from the economy as a result of the ban is a massive blow to many poor Afghans. The loss of jobs is also very significant, perhaps amounting to some 500,000 jobs, which people don't have an ability to replace. So both the economic consequences for Afghanistan's economy overall, but also particularly consequences for enormously vulnerable, enormously squeezed, just edge of starvation people is huge. And this on top of significant declines in humanitarian aid to Afghanistan. Last year, it was about $3 billion. This year, the short is at least $1
billion. Who in Afghanistan, Vonda, has been most affected by economic losses because of the crackdown on opium production?
Both very poor ordinary households that don't own land, they have to rent land to be able to engage in even subsistence farming, and they often are able to rent land only by paying back in opium, as well as large landed households. So much of the rural population has been involved in opium poppy cultivation for a long time. Some assessments estimate perhaps 3 million people. But the impact is much larger because the income, the profits from the drug economy have been enabling a lot of activity in the cities, like in constructions. They allowed families, households to access healthcare, education. Mm. All of this is taken away.
Well, one strategy has long been to give farmers a legal crop that could sub out the poppy cultivation. Is the Afghan government under the Taliban providing other crops or other ways of making a living for people affected?
They have been very effective in promoting the exports of easily extractable commodities such as surface level minerals. But beyond that, the Taliban has really not been able to foster new economic development. The Taliban has been approaching the international community to demand assistance. But this gets very tricky for the Western donors because of the Taliban's reprehensible behavior toward women and human rights, very brutal, dictatorial, dogmatic approach. The Taliban is seen as a pariah. Western governments do not want to recognize it, and they do not want to extend economic aid beyond humanitarian aid. Now, there are many alternative livelihood efforts around the world, and there have been a lot in Afghanistan, and most of them fail. It's one thing to have money for it. It's another thing to implement those programs effectively. So right now, there is no aid at all going to those that are really hurting, really suffering as a result of the ban. And my view is that we should reconsider our view of humanitarian aid, not to be just handing out immediate sort of non-starvation money, immediate food money, but to move from this band-aid approach to more sustainable local economic growth, such as in the agricultural programs.
Bottom line, Vonda, do you think the Taliban's efforts at cutting down opium production has made things better or worse for Afghans?
For Afghans, it has made things certainly worse. But I would also say the ban has made things worse for the international community.
In what way?
Because there is very high chance that if the ban is maintained and there emerges a heroin drought in Europe, and usually there is a lag of at least 2 years between what happens in an important production area and the retail markets, there is very high possibility that instead of heroin being supplied out of another country, international drug traffickers such as Mexican crime groups or Chinese trafficking networks will move in and start supplying Europe with fentanyl, a synthetic opioid that in North America has already unleashed the worst, most lethal drug epidemic ever in history.
Vonda Thelbeb-Brown is the director of the Initiative on Non-State Armed Actors and senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Vonda, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Sweden is a country that's usually associated with high living standards and gender equality. For a country in Europe, it also has some of the highest numbers of deaths from shootings. The homicide rate from guns in Sweden is 2.5 times the European average. Experts say marginalization of some communities, drug wars, and a failure by police to solve many gun crimes are all factors behind the numbers. As our Europe correspondent Orla Barry reports from Stockholm, local communities are fighting back.
On the first day I arrive in Stockholm, the local news channel is reporting on a shooting that happened early that morning.
På flera platser runt om I Stockholmsområdet har skottlossning rapporterats.
Gunfire has been reported in several areas of Stockholm, the reporter says. One man has died after being shot through the window of an apartment he was staying in. Diamon Salihu is one of the best-known crime journalists in Sweden. When I meet him, he's scrolling through his phone, reading about the man who was killed a few hours earlier.
I read his name for the first time last night because I was reading an investigation and I saw a list of names that the police had extracted from the phone. So this list is, according to the police, a list of enemies that this group is trying to take out.
The victim was a man in his 30s. But Salihu says many gang members in Sweden are often much younger than that.
There are so many children that are standing in line to take a spot because they see this as an opportunity.
I go to meet Peter Svensson. He was a member of one of Sweden's most notorious gangs for many years and started his life in crime as a young teenager. He tells me to meet him at an address in southern Stockholm.
Hello, I'm outside number 4. Okay, cheers.
About 10 minutes later, Svensson appears. He says he didn't want to give me his exact location because he has to be careful who he gives his details out to. Svensson is tall, well over 6 foot, and good-looking, with light brown hair and blue eyes. He says he was 12 when he committed his first crime.
I sold a bicycle for some older people who want to buy it. And I asked them if they want, like, mountain bikes. So they say they want. And the day after, I come with 2 mountain bikes. And then they say, oh, you're so good.
That was one of the first times, Svensson says, he ever got positive feedback for anything. And it felt good. Things weren't great at home.
My mother was sick and my father was drinking.
And being part of something made him feel special, he says. At the age of 20, Svensson was asked if he wanted to join a gang called the Brotherhood Wolfpack, and he was thrilled. Over the next few years, Svensson worked his way up through the ranks of the gang, committing violent crimes involving drugs and extortion, and he ended up in prison several times.
The first was in 1998, like 1 month, and 2004 months, 2006, 4 years.
What did you do in 2006 that you got 4 years?
Like beating somebody up and shooting at somebody.
Did they die?
No.
A couple of years into his last prison sentence, Svensson was placed in solitary confinement after an incident with another inmate. And he says it was then he began to question everything about his life. He wrote a letter to the prison governor saying he wanted out of the gang. She took him seriously and set things in motion for Svensson. But he says leaving that life wasn't easy.
And I was nobody because I know who I am in the criminal life. But in this life, I don't know who I am.
After he was released from prison, a group called Exit helped Svensson move to another city, away from former gang members. Exit is part of a large non-profit organisation called Frisuset. It works with marginalised communities in Sweden, where some of these gangs often originate. In the Frisuset Centre in Stockholm, kids are sitting around chatting and listening to music. The group runs a number of schools in Sweden, and provides training in everything from dance to skateboarding and basketball.
This place gave me an environment where I could develop my talents in creativity, you know, dancing, music.
This is Wesley Teodoro. He says he applied to go to the school when he was 14.
I did not feel comfortable or safe or like accepted in the schools that I had gone to earlier. And I just needed a place where I could find that, you know.
Frizu said schools now have around 2,000 students. Camilla Salazar-Athias is a manager at the centre. She says some of the kids coming to their centres are already involved in gangs.
They are being fooled into thinking that it's action and it's a lot of money and it's a world that is fascinating and they are being part of something that is cool or whatever.
Like Peter Svensson, Salazar-Athias says many of the young gang members she meets crave a sense of belonging. Peter Svensson now works with a group called Cateena, which helps those who want to leave gangs and criminal networks. Svensson says the first thing they do is help the former gang member come up with a new identity.
You start to change how you look. If you have tattoos, you take this away, or you new tattoos. The way how you talk and the place you're staying.
It's so other gang members can't track you down, he says. In the longer term, though, it's all about changing the person's mindset, he says. Shootings have soared in Sweden in the last few years. Crime journalist Theoman Salihu says only around 25% of gun homicide cases have been solved, and that leads to a lack of trust in police and more revenge killings. Far-right politicians have blamed the rise in gang violence on Sweden's migrant communities. But Salihu says many of the gangs today are made up of young people born and raised here, and he says this isn't just a Swedish problem.
Because the drugs are, that we see here, that are being bought by the rich and poor people, they're being smuggled to ports in Spain, to ports in Belgium and in the Netherlands, and all that ends up getting to our streets.
And this makes it an international problem, Salihu says. And it's one we all have to fight together. For The World, I'm Orla Barry, Stockholm.
Tomorrow on the show, a different story from Scandinavia, focusing on a well-known series of books for kids. The Moomins are storybooks and comic strips from Finland, all about love and family with a heavy dose of fantasy. After decades as beloved Finnish characters, the Moomins have picked up steam internationally. We'll learn why tomorrow on the show. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong, and we'll see you right back here tomorrow. From PRX.